As usual, I'd like to respond to questions which are asked of me just before the talk, or questions we get on emails. And the questions from emails and people this evening give me a sort of a subject to talk about, very sort of strong Buddhist subjects of, you know, anicca or change. And I'm going to weave a talk about that, but with some examples which people just asked me today. And the first place where I will start was a question which came on the internet. It's a question where they said that there are some things in science which are laws, which are given, which don't change. But then again, the Buddha said that everything does change. Is that a contradiction? And especially they mentioned the old science paradigm of the conservation of energy. And I've mentioned this before. I mentioned this in a talk I gave in Singapore about 10 days ago, when I gave a talk on creation or evolution, sort of how do they fit together. And it was because I was a scientist before, theoretical physicist, and because I'm a Buddhist now and understand the nature of the mind, it was a question which bothered me for a while. You know, where did this material of the universe come from? And if you, conservation of energy means you can't create something out of nothing. And you know, the answer was very clear, that you can have an answer which bridges that contradiction. Sometimes in life when we see there's a contradiction, it's actually because we don't actually see things from the correct angle. We just change our perspective and see there's no contradiction there at all. And the solution comes, you know, from a little bit of science, to notice that this thing we call mass energy, or the stuff of this universe, is not always in its positive form. There's something which we call negative energy. And the example which many people know from their high school days is what they call potential energy. I'm not going to carry on. This is not a science lecture, but this just gives an indication of what I'm going to talk about later on. That potential energy is where you have like a massive object and some sort of force field, like a gravitational field, and that has actually a negative component to its energy. In other words, to free it from the Earth's gravitational field, it takes energy. So being here in the Earth's gravitational field means you have a little bit of negative energy. So there is such a concept in physics of negative energy. And there's also the positive energy. And I remember many years ago when I gave a talk with Abbot Placid, the former abbot of New Norcia, and Professor David Blair from UWA, and myself, when we sort of discussed religion and science, I remember turning around to Professor Blair, the professor of physics at UWA, and asking, what would it actually be like if the amount of negative energy in this universe exactly cancelled out the amount of positive energy in this universe? In other words, it's like a zero sum. And I remember at that point he turned around to me and he said, wow, you're really up to date, Ajahn Brahm. And he said, omega equals one, he remembers saying. This omega, they always have these letters for physical things in science. So omega apparently is the ratio of negative energy and positive energy in this universe, according to what he said. And it's like equal to one. In other words, it totally balances out. So in other words, the amount of mass, stuff, energy in this universe, if you bring it all together, it totally cancels out into zero. So basically, this thing which we see with all of the stuff of this universe, if we could bring it together, it would come together as nothing. Zero, emptiness, famous Buddhist sunyata. So we came out of nothing. And basically right now we're nothing. We'll go back to nothing. The zero-sum game, totally. I really like that. I said as a joke, I think, a few days ago, that there's a TV program called The Biggest Loser. Monks are Buddhists. Buddhists are the biggest losers. We attach to nothing at all. We let go of everything. So the biggest losers are Buddhists. So welcome to the Biggest Loser Club. In other words, we lose everything till there's nothing left, because there's nothing there to begin with. So this whole universe comes from nothing. It's just a plus and minus, totally balancing each other, but separated, and then eventually comes back together into nothing. Just like your consciousness. Where did your consciousness come from? People often asked. Sort of a separation of negative and positive. I know that some of you think you've got more negative energy in your consciousness than positive energy, but you hang around the Buddhist society for a long time and we'll balance that out. But eventually it balances out to nothingness, and that's the deep peace and stillness in meditation where you totally vanish, it's all gone. So it's actually interesting because it's from nothing. That's why it can change and disappear totally. So that actually answers the question. It's not a contradiction, because you can have change. And it can be coming from nothing, going back to nothing. It's like impermanence, inconstant, not always the same. And that to me, when you first hear that, sometimes that can be quite frightening, because it's the nature of human being always to like some stability, some place which you can sit down and have a rest. And a lot of times people think that you need something stable to sit on and rest in life, which is why we want the stable relationship. We want the people we love to always be around all the time. You know, we want to have some sense of certainty in the economy of the country or the stability of this place, so we can have a community, a nation where we can feel safe, that we're going to raise our children, everything's going to be okay. But you know, the nature of the world is not like that. Things are in constant flux and change, to the point that when we become aware of this, we realize that, you know, there is a deep instability in this world, in this nation, in this existence. And we really have to come to terms with that as soon as possible. And how do we come to terms with the changing nature of our life? Obviously, that when you don't come to terms with the changing nature of our life, that is called attachment, that's called delusion. And that's when we have loved ones with us and we don't let them change. Like, you know, your partners in life. I guarantee that your partner today was not the same as when you married them a few months ago. They will always change. And you just cannot keep them the same. Wouldn't it be wonderful when you married your beautiful wife if she was always the same? No beautiful 21-year-old, or I don't know what age you married her at. Unfortunately, she grows old and her hair sort of starts to turn grey and other things begin to sag. But you wish your husband was always the same, just when you were going out together, always attentive and nicely dressed, and now he's just, you know, he too is just a bit stinky under the armpits and a bit old and just decrepit. But this is the nature. We've got to let this happen, and especially we have to let it happen when eventually they disappear from us. You know, in death, that's part of like change. And if we don't allow ourselves to understand that and to accept it, we always think that the people we love are going to be there forever, and that's the problem. And one of the great sayings of the Buddha is, all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will one day become separated from me. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will one day become separated from me. Always try and remember that. Because what that actually means, you know, is that, you know, we enjoy the company of the things we love. We enjoy them, but we know that one day they will go. And it's not a frightening feeling when we understand it deeply. In fact, it's quite a beautiful feeling, as I will now demonstrate with one of Ajahn Chah's great similes. He would actually pick up a cup. And now this is the reason why we have so many glass or cup similes, because that's all the visual aids I have sitting next to me. Well, maybe you've got the bell and the bong or whatever, but we always use what we have next to us. So he said, he'd hold up a cup and he said, can you see the crack in the cup? And I would look carefully to see where it was cracked, and I just couldn't see it, and I wondered what he was up to. And he said, it is cracked, but it's microscopic, you can't really see it. But one day, he said, someone's going to kick that glass, or they're going to drop it, and the crack is going to open up, and it's going to be destroyed. Because it's the nature of glass to have cracks, faults, which open up when you drop them. He said, it's fragile. He said, because it's a glass which has a crack in it and it's fragile, it will one day be destroyed. He said, Brahma Wangsa, that's why you have to look after it and care for it. And he made this observation, if this was like a plastic cup, then you could throw it around, you could drop it, you could kick it, and it was unbreakable, which means you would not have to care for it. He said, because it's anicca, it means it's impermanent, it's subject to change. He said, that's why you must care for it. He said, just like one another, your children, your partner, your friends, your cat, your dog, you know that they are changing all the time. That one day you will become separated from them. One day the crack will appear. Either they die or you die or they go off to the other side of the world and you're left here or the other way round. There's a crack coming. So, if they're always going to be there, always healthy, young, fit, you would not need to care. No more than you'd need to care for an unbreakable plastic cup. But because they're fragile, that is why we have to care. And to me that opened up not only the reality of change, but also the way we deal with change. And the wisdom and the compassion which always comes when we understand the nature of change. The fact that we're not always going to be here together, which means there's not enough time to get angry at each other and say bad things, because the day might come when you can't say sorry and they're gone. I know that's a terrible thing, because I remember that from my own life when my father died at 16. And you know that I told many stories about my father and how much I loved him and how much of an influence he was in my life. But I wasn't the perfect son. And I did stupid things. And one of the things I felt guilty about when my father died, which I really thought I should have said sorry for, was competition in our taste in music. Because my father would love Frank Sinatra. As for me, I loved Jimi Hendrix. And sometimes when he put on his Frank Sinatra record, I would put off my Jimi Hendrix record. And as you all know, Jimi Hendrix is far louder than Frank Sinatra. And so I drowned his music out. And it was a stupid thing, but it was just like, you know, 14 or 15 year old, you're in competition with the other males in the house, even your father or your brother. It's just, you know, that psychology of a male growing up. And so many, many times I did that. A stupid young man. And then when he died, it was too late to say sorry. You know, little things like that you feel guilty about. You feel, okay, you know, you can listen to his... I want my father to enjoy his Frank Sinatra music and whatever, but I felt guilty about that. And I always remember from that experience, look, while there is still time, always, you know, say sorry. Because the time comes when you just can't say it anymore. So take the opportunity, because change happens. You cannot rely on people always being around. And it's beautiful when you realize that it's changing and situations, they come today and they don't sort of come again tomorrow. It means that you do grab the opportunity, you know, to say what's really important in life. The old sort of story which many sort of monastics, you know, of all traditions, of all religions, we often practice, you know, this when you go to bed at night, you know, we realize that we might not wake up in the morning. We all know that the bed is the most dangerous place where most people die. So that's why we try and spend as least possible time in bed as monks. Otherwise, you know, we're lessening our chance of dying. But anyway, knowing that we sort of reflect that maybe we'll not wake up in the morning, maybe this might be our last day, so we always try and be ready for that change of, you know, death or whatever. And when you're always ready for it, it means actually that you really live life. You really are in this life, because every day is so precious, because, you know, you don't know how many more days you've got left. And I said this in Singapore as well. It's quite a while since I said this here. That, you know, because I was, you know, a physicist, there's also a bit of maths involved there. And I was always very good at mental arithmetic. So I know there's roughly about 300 people in this room today. And I always make the calculations. There's 300 people in this room. According to statistics, that means about four of you will be dead by this time next year. That's according to statistics. It's true. Which four is it? And don't just look at the old ones. You know, young people die as well. And it's true, I can guarantee that. You know, on average, about four of you will be dead by this time next year. Maybe more, maybe a bit less. And that could be you. So make sure this next year is a good one. Now, you know, when you get close to that, it doesn't create any fear at all. It actually makes life more interesting and more alive. We don't waste so much time. Because we know the glass has got a crack in it, it means we actually care. And it also means when the glass does crack, we don't think, oh, it's gone, what a tragedy. We realise, yes, I expected that. It's part of nature. When the cat dies, we don't get upset because we always expected that from the very first time we had it as a kitten. We knew that this was the destiny. Had a crack in it, it would one day break and fall apart. But if we've cared for that cat all our life, we think, wow, what a great time we've had together. Thank you so much. When a person dies, what a wonderful time we've had together. I'd cherish that. I wouldn't have missed that experience for the world. You know, when sort of a relationship finally breaks down, why is it that we just get so upset? You've had a beautiful time together. Many weeks, months, or maybe even years. Years of love and fun and enjoyment. What a wonderful time we've had together. Thank you so much. That's why I think that, you know, sometimes divorces, we should do that much better. A divorce should be another party. Oh, thank you, we are a great time. Now's the time to move on. Wonderful time we've had together. It's amazing how people look at things in a really weird way. I've often wondered just, you know, why, you know, part of change is also letting things go. And that's when we have to let the cup go. And why do we keep carrying just the pain of the past, I often notice. I told people again in the talks I gave in Singapore that many of you have photo albums. People are always taking these photographs. But, you know, they take photographs of the wrong things. They take photographs of the happy times, you know, the marriages, or, you know, the graduations, those kids who've, you know, finished year 12 or got their university degrees, take all these photographs. But why don't we take photographs of our divorce and put that on the mantelshelf? Here's me and my ex-wife at the lawyers. Why don't, you know, we always take photographs of, you know, when we're on holiday, you know, over in Bali or wherever else you're going to go this holiday. Why don't we take photographs of here's me and the dentist with all his stuff on me? That'd be wonderful. Take photographs of, like, down Cottesloe Beach. Now, why don't we take photographs down the morgue? Oh, no, here's me taking, you know, the rubbish down to the tip. I've never seen anybody, we actually go down the tip every now and again to take, you know, the excess rubbish from our monastery. You know, we can't put it in the bin, so we send it to the recycling place. But I've never seen anybody at the tip sort of pose in front of the big rubbish pile, smile and take a camera and put it in the album or put it on front of the, on the wall. But we always take photographs of beautiful things, don't we? Of nice memories. That's what we put on the photograph albums. What do we put in the photograph albums of our head, of our mind? That's where we put all the tip photographs, all the divorce photographs, all the negative memories of our life. It's incredible just how in the photo albums we only have beautiful, happy memories. But in the photograph album between your ears, you always keep the ugly photographs. How stupid that is. So because things change, actually, I don't keep photographs. People give me all these photographs and I keep them for a while and then throw them away or burn them. What do you want to keep photographs for? Life is always changing. Why do you want to always sort of somehow capture it and put it on ice? It's much, much better actually to let go of the past and just be with change. and let things flow and be with the flow, rather always lingering on the past. Because when you keep thinking about the past, you're not actually free to be in this moment. Now, again, somebody was actually asking me this very nice question. They were a bit concerned about the wild horses in the Kimberley, which were going to be culled. You know, and just these are very beautiful animals, free, just healthy, just in the Kimberleys, running wild, enjoying their lives, you know, free in nature. And sometimes you see that and you get this feeling of inspirational freedom. They're just running in nature without any sort of hindrances, not trained by human beings, just according to their own nature. But apparently there's too many of them, and so they're going to send the helicopters in to shoot them, to kill them. And you know, as a Buddhist, so I'm just not a Buddhist, as a human being, I think there's something yucky in that. What are you actually doing that for? And then if you're going to cull anything, you might cull us. There's too many of us in this planet. We're the ones causing the problems. But you can imagine like a helicopter coming around Perth to cull the population of Perth. Would any government be able to understand that? Horses, okay. Kangaroos, okay. Rabbits, okay. But people, you know, why? You know, actually, we're the biggest pest on this planet. And when you think of the amount of damage we do. But anyhow, I told her, look, that when there's a big problem like that, just you have to, from compassion, think, what can you do about that? Is there something you can really do? You know, when you're worrying about things which you can have no appreciable effect on, you're actually neglecting this present moment when there's something you really can do. When you're worrying about all the people who are starving in maybe sort of some poor country in Africa or in Haiti, say, it means you're not actually looking at something you can really do right now, such as like the Bangladesh orphanage, something where you can make an effect. I know there's a monk, you know, when I was idealistic when I became a monk, I always remain idealistic. You know, I stand up for my principles. You know, I was just talking to some of the monks this afternoon about all the things I've stood up for in my life. You know, I always really enjoyed doing this. It feels like you've got some inner strength. I remember standing up for the gay community when there was an article appeared in the newspaper. It began in the Sunday Telegraph, which quoted the Dalai Lama as saying you can't be a Buddhist and a gay at the same time. I thought, that's wrong. I can't allow that. So I wrote a letter to the newspaper and it got published. I got some sort of comments, you cannot sort of criticize a Dalai Lama, but you can criticize anybody, criticize me, I get it wrong sometimes. But there's no person in this world who can't be criticized. And that's not being sort of disrespectful. You know, more important than the person is like the truth, compassion. So you know, we don't worship people, we worship principles. So I stood up for the gay community and I was very happy. I got some comments back which were negative, but my reward for that was being invited to the gay pride breakfast. I was very proud of that award. You know, I always remember that, it was really good fun, rocking up to this gay pride breakfast and saying a few words. I remember what I said. I said, you know, in this whole meeting over here, you're all gays, but I'm more deviant than any one of you. I'm celibate. And you know, being celibate, having no sex at all, is even more weird than being homosexual, which is actually very true. In fact, it's so weird that sometimes people say that, you know, if you are sort of celibate, there must be something very, very wrong with you. And there's nothing wrong with me at all. In fact, I want to actually stand up for celibate rights. In fact, I want one day to actually have my own float on the gay and lesbian Mardi Gras for celibates. Stand up for celibacy. No, celibate rights. We demand freedom. Things have got to change. Because no, if we don't actually work for change, sometimes it's, we know that society will always change. It's an evolution. You know, this is the nature of our existence, and we have to go along with that change. Sometimes we have to nudge it along a bit, you know, just like the bhikkhuni issue. It's obvious, this is the 21st century, this is Australia. You can't sort of live in the past. It's possible. Why can't we have equity between monks and between men and women? It doesn't make any sense to me, so we push it forward a little bit. And this is what we have to do. So things have to change. We have to work with that change. But you know, sometimes our problem is that sometimes we, just like the problem with the horses in the Kimberley, sometimes that we expend energy on things which we can't really effect a change upon. We waste so much of our energy and effort. And when there is something to do, we just miss it. We miss the opportunities. And a lot of wisdom is finding out, you know, where you can actually make a change, where you can't make a change. You just have to let things be. And one of the stories which I remember, which this was one of the monks told me this story. It's one of the stories that opened the door of your heart. I don't really mention a lot. But it was a great story. He was, this monk, he was from New Zealand. And he was trekking over in New Zealand with one of his friends. They call it tramping over there. It was a hot day, just like, you know, the weather today. It's been really hot today. And he was walking, you know, all day. And he managed actually to get to this pristine beach somewhere in the, I don't know, South Island, I think it was. It was one of those magnificent beaches, secluded. No one was there. They had it to themselves. You know, it's a sort of beach you build a resort on if it was, you know, in sort of close proximity to civilization. But this was totally wild. And so it was only him and his mate there. And they were very hot. And they thought, yes, go for a swim. And, you know, a very natural decision. So they stripped off. They didn't need any bathers. There's no one around. And off he went into the water and did some swimming. And that's when he realized that he made a big mistake, because there was a big rip there. This very, very strong current. And later on, he survived, obviously, to tell the story, but later on he told me that, you know, many people had perished on that particular beach. He didn't realize that it was so dangerous. But how he survived was a very brilliant strategy, and I think it's because he'd been a Buddhist before. You know, he was a Buddhist monk, obviously, but the teachings of Buddhism actually saved his life there. Because as he was being taken out by the strong current, straight away he realized it was such a strong sort of rip current that fighting it was useless. So he totally relaxed. He let go. He didn't try to do anything. He let that current take him a long way from the beach, knowing that eventually that current will stop. It will change. It is impermanent. Eventually the force will wither away. And eventually it did. And that's where he started swimming. That's where he put forth all his effort. When he could make a difference, that's when he applied himself. And he managed to swim back to the shore, exhausted. But he survived. And he told me that if he'd have fought that current, he'd have still been taken the same distance away from shore. But when he got to that distance, he would have been exhausted. He would not have been able to swim back. He would have died. Knowing when to let go and when to put forth effort saved his life. But more importantly, having the courage to let go. The courage to let go when you know that you can't do anything, but you're really scared of what might happen. He did let go. And that saved his life. And that was a very beautiful simile about, you know, what happens in life, that sometimes in life you are being taken away from safety, away from security, and it's such a strong current. If you're wise, you realize you can't resist this. You have to go with the flow. You've got no choice, even if it's painful, if it's scary, go with it. But then when there's something you can do, you've preserved your energy, you've got strength, then you can apply yourself. And that's really helped me so often in life, because there are situations which are sometimes so difficult and so problematical, and you wonder what the heck you should do. And I remember that story, just go with it, flow with it. It's going to change. It will never always be like this. So just endure, don't be afraid. It's going to change. And once it does change, then you can do something about it. That's when you put forth your efforts. But it's the courage comes from knowing that it's not going to last like this. It is going to change. And so often, you know, part of my job is counseling you people. And, you know, actually, I shouldn't really say that, because every time I say that, people line up afterwards. And they say, you know what happens, you get telephone calls and people come up to you. And I'm not a professional counselor. We've got no insurance. So if we've got the wrong advice, you know, our Buddhist society is in big trouble. So maybe you should go to a professional one. But anyhow, you know, we give sort of kind advice because we're just human beings. But a lot of times the kind advice is just remember it will pass. This too will pass. You know, one of the great stories Actually, I couldn't write that in Open the Door of the Heart because somebody else had written it before me, and so they were worried about copyright. But it's a great story of the Emperor's Ring. I know you've heard it before, but please remember this because it actually is a great story and it works. In fact, one of you, I forget who you were, I'm not sure if you're here tonight, actually got a ring made with the same words on the outside, which this emperor did. Because it was a young boy, became the emperor, and whenever things went well in the kingdom, he just held a party, held celebrations. And he was partying and celebrating so much that, of course, you know, the good times never lasted that long. And whenever there was a problem in the kingdom, he would just go to his room and sulk and get depressed, which meant the bad times lasted longer than everybody thought they should. He was a very ineffective ruler of his kingdom. Good times, party. Bad times, sulk. Does that remind you of anybody? So, fortunately, he had some very wise advisers, but you've got to be very careful if you're advising a king. You say the wrong words and you know, you're put in jail or killed. So that they managed to have this brilliant idea. They decided to get the king a ring, a gold ring, which was very simple, except the words which were written on the outside, engraved on the outside, which were, "This too will pass. This too will pass." And the king wore that ring. And whenever there was good times going in the kingdom, "This too will pass." It will change. It's subject to change. And because of that, because he knew the good times would change, yeah, he would have parties, but not so often, because he realized he had to work hard to make sure those good times lasted long, because they were subject to change. When the bad times came, and he was in really big trouble, he didn't get so depressed because he knew, yeah, it does change. This is such a fundamental law of life. But when we forget it, it meant that, you know, we get depressed, we sulk, or we just party all the time. We get the highs and lows. Well, Rodney was telling me just, you know, the thing, just before I went, where did I go? I think to Thailand. The last time I travelled, I think the Australian cricket team were in big trouble. I think how many tests have been so far? This is the third one, is it? I think that's for the second test. And they sort of were losing, and he asked me to do some chanting for them. Didn't work because they lost. So many people in Australia were getting fed up. And this time I think they're winning. So he asked me if I'd been chanting for them this time. It's not sometimes you win, sometimes you lose, this too will pass. Sometimes you win the cup or the ashes and then you lose them again. This is the nature of life. So you better instead of... But apparently after losing the second match, many Australians got depressed. And they went into their rooms and sulked, turned off the TV, you know, went to the pub and got drunk or whatever. And that's a stupid response to when things go bad in life. They all pass, and it's passing. So in this one we might win, we'll probably lose the next one, and then win the next one. So a lot of times, instead of getting depressed and upset, remember it will pass, just like the Emperor's Ring. And that just actually shows you a truth of life. No matter how bad it gets, it won't last. And of course, I can't resist telling that story of another Ajahn Chah story from my youth when I was very, very sick in hospital. I was really sick. It was scrub typhus in this third world hospital in Ubon in Thailand. It was 35 years ago. And I mean, that was just really, really basic. This was the time, the years when they had reusable needles. The ones you have now, you use them once and you're disposed. Imagine having a needle and you have to keep reusing it again and again and again. And of course, Thailand was a poor country 35 years ago, so they'd use it many, many times. They couldn't afford so many new needles. So they had to use them as many times as they possibly could in Bangkok. And then they'd send them up to the provinces in Ubon. They'd use them on the poor farmers in this province. And after using them on the farmers, then they would use them on the monks, because we were the tough people. And that's what it felt like. Because I was really sick with some fever, and I didn't know what it was. So they would inject me twice a day in my bum. And it wasn't an injection, because I always remember that nurse. You know, she was built like a pro wrestler. It's really tough because, you know, she never injected me. She actually stabbed me. Oh, and I hated that nurse. Even though I was supposed to be a Buddhist, I could not give her any loving kindness at all. Every time I saw her. My body was so sore after a couple of weeks of that, every morning and afternoon. So, you know, and you've got a fever. When you've got a fever for such a long time, you just lose all your energy and you feel really dull and depressed. So you can imagine, I'll just set the scene, and then, you know, your teacher comes in to see you. Now, Ajahn Chah, this great famous monk. You know, I was only a small monk, a young monk, and I thought, what a wonderful thing that somebody so important comes to see me. And for a few minutes, I felt so happy and so... all the aches and pains and sort of feeling of despondency all disappeared until he opened his mouth. He taught me Buddhism, Dhamma. I wish he hadn't. Because what he said is Brahma Wangso. He said, yes, you'll either get better or you'll die. And then he left. He was very wise, but his bedside manner was needed some adjustment. And the worst thing about that is you can't challenge that. That's just so true. You either get better or you die. Either way, the sickness doesn't last. Isn't that a great relief? If you understand the nature of change, it is a great relief. It means you don't have to be with that torture of sickness forever. So please, if you're going to visit a sick relation in hospital this period, this weekend, please go up to them and say, darling, you're either going to get better or you're going to die. Let's see what they say. But it just shows that these things change in life. And look, you know, if you're Buddhist, you know, if not Buddhist, it's the same anyway. You know, if you do die, you get reborn again. So, you know, look, if you've got a rotten old car and it's really falling apart, then obviously you trade it in for a new one. So if you've got some cancer or disease and you're falling apart, isn't it much nicer to, you know, to trade it in for a new one, get reborn again? It's obvious it makes sense. So when somebody's actually dying, getting old and sick and about to die, say, wow, you know, you're going to get a new model soon. What one do you want? But just like your car, you know, if you sort of get stolen or if it gets sort of, you have a crash. Now, the car you get next time depends on your insurance you paid this time. If you paid a lot of insurance and kept up the premiums, then you get a very good car in the next lifetime. Just the same way, an insurance premium is all your donations you give to the Buddhist Society of West Australia or to the Bangladesh Orphanage. If you keep up your premiums and you have to sort of die this afternoon or this evening, then of course you get a really good model in your next lifetime, the equivalent in body of like a Rolls Royce or a Ferrari. But if you're really stingy and you don't do good karma in your next life, you might get sort of one of those Toyotas they always recalling. I should have said that again. This is the second time I've said that. A very bad, an old bomb of a car. So remember, keep up your insurance premiums, which is good karma in your life. Then if you do happen to die, you always get a good car and you look forward to it. So, you know, if you made lots and lots of good karma, you say, wow, bring it on. But anyway, you all know that, you know, change happens, so one day we'll all have to go. But there's another thing you've changed, which somebody asked me. They said to us, many, many people, I wonder that if you become a Buddhist, do you have to become a Buddhist forever, for life? And look, even being a Buddhist, things change. How many of your ideas, the way, the concepts, the way you look at life have changed since you were born? Well, I've changed many, many times the way you look at life and how you deal with life. And someone was saying that sometimes people, maybe they've become sort of a Christian or a Muslim or a Buddhist or whatever when they were young. And do they always have to be like that? And of course you don't always have to be like that. One of the great understandings of life is that we do flow, we do change, we will change our ideas and the way we look at things in life. And so the idea that once you sort of join a particular religion, you always have to stay in that religion, that doesn't make any sense to me at all. In fact, that's against the Article 18 of the human rights, fundamental human rights, is the ability to choose a religion or not to choose a religion or even to change a religion. So you can always change, as you will always change. It's the nature of life. And a lot of times, the truth, common sense, if you wish to call it, wisdom, compassion and kindness, the sorts of thing which is even more beyond the religions, is, you know, the thing which actually underpins all the real wisdom and spirituality of our world, is actually understanding that, you know, things do change. Your ideas will change, you will grow, you will evolve. In that talk which I gave about creation and evolution a few weeks ago, I said, look, it's not just the evolution of the species, it's the evolution of you. You notice that you have evolved. You know, your mind has evolved, your wisdom, your compassion has evolved. And over the last few years even, let alone since you were born. And you can actually see that happening. And as you evolve, the ideas you have about your life will change as well. And again, in the relationships you have with your partner, if you don't allow that evolution to happen, you know, you're finding out that you're resisting sort of the truth of, you know, a relationship, the truth of time, which is things are always going to change. But there's something which is more fundamental there, which is like the acceptance of change. A lot of times, that, you know, what real love and compassion is allowing things to change and allowing things to leave when it, sort of the change demands that way, like with its death or whether it's a graduation where kids leave your home to go and live with somebody else. That's why I say that great wisdom and love accepts change and allows letting go. And when that sort of parting does come, we realize we had such a wonderful time together. And there's never any sadness there. Now, all sadness and suffering is actually wanting from the world what it can never give you. Expecting just what's not real. And if we actually align, you know, our wants to what the world can really offer, when our wisdom is such that we never ask what we can't get, then all of our suffering and pain actually disappears. Actually flowing with life and not trying to fight against this current. In that way that we realize that we are wise people, we understand this wonderful thing of change, we allow change. You know that sometimes people ask, even as a monk, are you a monk forever? Now, once you become a monk or a nun, is it such thing as life vows? And I was very impressed that the Buddha never allowed such thing as life vows. And you could leave becoming a monk at any time you want. I've been a monk now over 36 years, and I could leave this evening if I wanted to. It's very easy to leave. So the only reason you stay as a monk is because you're enjoying it. You're getting some benefits, some value out of it. And that's the same with life. You know, we have to accept that change. And if it's really working, it's worthwhile, wonderful, carry on. But you know, one of the reasons we had that is because it would be a terrible, terrible thing if there was a person, say, in a monastery, for monks or nuns, who just didn't want to be there, but had to be there because of some decision they made maybe 20, 30 years ago. Wouldn't that be a rotten thing to be like in a prison that way? You know, you've changed, life has changed, and this is not the right place for you anymore. In the same way that you can sometimes change your jobs or places of abode, you don't feel you're not comfortable in there anymore. So the Buddha actually allowed that. In fact, you may not know that you're allowed actually to disrobe six times, and ordain seven times. It was all about one monk many, many years ago in the time of the Buddha. And he became a monk, but as soon as he became a monk, he missed his wife. So, you know, longing for his wife and being a bit homesick, he disrobed. And as soon as he got home, he said, why did I come back for this? And then he ordained again. And as soon as he got ordained, he got homesick again. So he did that six or seven times. And the very last time, sort of, you know, he got fed up with his wife. So he went back to the monastery. And they were about to say, not you again. Make up your mind. But on the way to the monastery, he became enlightened. So they accepted him in. And that was the last time. He became a monk for the seventh time. And so with that tradition now, in many, many countries, you're only allowed to become a monk seven times. Disrobe six times. One more time, you can't make up your mind, you know, no more. But it does actually allow that sort of acceptance of change. If we don't allow that acceptance of change, we're fighting against the truth of things. And fighting against the truth of life is called suffering. And none of us want that. So I'm much happy to have, a much more, you know, as a senior monk, I feel much, much more confident and happy to have people who want to be here rather than people who don't want to be here. And the same in your life as well. Allow change to happen. So don't fight it all the time. If you actually can sort of not be afraid of change, when we're not afraid of change, we can be very adaptive. We enjoy the time we have together. And we find that when that change happens and then there's a parting or there's a moving away, we don't feel sad. We feel, what a wonderful time we've had together. What a great thing this has been. Yeah, the cup is now broken, but while it was here, I loved this, I cared for it. And of course it lasts much longer that way. We cared for it and loved it, had many, many wonderful cups of water from you, glass. And that way there's never any sadness. There's a sense of gratitude and acceptance and love of life. So I think it's wonderful actually when we understand that sort of change is something which, you know, we have to deal with, we have to become one with, we have to flow with, rather than always resisting in our life. And again, sometimes it's because that people are afraid. They're afraid that that if they go to that new place, that new position, that new whatever it is, they think that somehow or other they're going to lose a lot and they're going to suffer more. It's a sense of insecurity. But it's a sense of insecurity when we always define ourselves as being with this partner or that job or whatever. In my life as a monk, I find that just the roles I have to play change so much that sometimes I don't know who I'm supposed to be. So much so you can adapt to being anybody. Sometimes you have to be very serious, right, when you're sort of taking funeral services, except for that funeral service I gave for one of our members a couple of weeks ago, Mike Wright. Many of you, if you saw him, you'd remember him, he was a regular here. And at the end of his funeral service, sort of, he told his wife this apparently, that the last song or piece of music at the end of his funeral service was from The Life of Brian, Look on the Bright Side of Life. I really recommend that for funeral services for Buddhists. It got made everybody sort of laugh and happy at the very end. So, you know, he could allow that change. And we can sort of allow some of even the ceremonies to change. So sometimes you have to be serious, but sometimes you can actually change and adapt to the situations and circumstances. And that's such an important thing to do in life. Now, there is times when you sort of look at a person and you're serious and you empathize with them, and sometimes there's a time when you adapt to those situations, which means sometimes you tell a joke, sometimes you just sit there and listen, sometimes you speak. And be able to change is so important. The trouble is that when we have these ideas and rules of what we should do and how we should do it, we find we're so stiff we can never adapt to the time and to the place. So in order to effect change, I've been practicing for years. I encourage this practice for you. Always actually put aside all of the rules and the training. All the things which you are meant to do and supposed to do. Put them aside for a moment. And just be in this moment. Be kind. Be compassionate. Be wise. And just adapt to this moment. And there you find that all the rules, especially as a monk I'm supposed to keep, are kept quite naturally without any force. Because all those rules for monks are always about kindness and selflessness, simplicity and peace. And if you can actually just adapt to this moment, you find all the rules, whether you're a psychologist, whether you're a nurse, a doctor, a bricklayer, whatever. If you can just change with this moment, now you find actually that you can become very skilled, adaptive in whatever you do in life. Whenever you are tied down by this is the way it should be done, this is the way it's always been done. Yeah, it works in most situations, but sometimes it doesn't work now, which is why one needs to have this beautiful ability to adapt to each moment as it appears in your life, and to be able to change at a moment's notice. Without that ability, you find that you miss so much in life and you don't find much success in your life. I remember just when a group of, again, I get into some interesting situations, there was a group of Buddhist military who came to see me in UK a few years ago. Just like in all parts of life, you know, even in the British Army, there were many Buddhists. I thought those Buddhists would be in the ancillary services, such as like the dentist or the accountants, but some of these Buddhists were frontline soldiers who'd fought in Iraq and Afghanistan. Is that a good thing for Buddhists to be doing? I'm not going to judge, but that's where they were. And that's what they were doing. And so, you know, I had to change many of my attitudes. And I'm willing to change those attitudes to face these people in front of me who were obviously very sincere. They weren't bad people. I could sense straight away they had a very strong inner morality in them. And how can that be? It was a contradiction in all that was ever told about Buddhism. And so one of the things I told them is never allow your knowledge to stand in the way of truth. I remember they just were shocked by that and said, yeah! Because my knowledge was telling me that what these guys were doing is wrong. But the truth in front of my eyes that these were beautiful people. Which is the one you're supposed to follow? If you follow your knowledge, you'll make so many mistakes. You'll be judgmental, critical, harsh, and you'll never be able to connect and appreciate and respect people. The truth of the matter was something different. It was a wonderful experience. I still don't understand. I still haven't really processed that totally. But isn't that the case so many times in your life? You've been in situations like that which have totally challenged everything you've known. And there you have to follow one of the other sayings which I made some years ago. The two types of religions in the world. The first type of religion is what bends the truth to fit the faith. What is your faith? You're Buddhist, Christian, whatever. How many of times do you bend the truth to fit those? The faith. If I'm a Buddhist, it must be this way. You bend the facts. And the other one is what really should be a religious, spiritual person. You bend the faith to fit the facts. In other words, it doesn't matter what your beliefs are. If the facts, the truth in front of you is different, you have to bend your faith. For those of you who are devout Buddhists, that's the Kalama Sutta in a nutshell. Bending the faith to fit the truth. Do you ever notice that most religious leaders were rebels? They always ended up in a cross or in big trouble. So the reason why they're rebels, because actually they saw things in a deeper way. They challenged, which I think is sometimes very useful. To challenge, to move things forward, to have the ability to change, and there will always be a resistance to change. So which is why we have to rebel in that inner sense against our preconceived ideas, to be willing to change. To actually to be able to challenge everything, so there's not one sacred cow willing to bend anything to fit the truth, the facts in front of us. And we never allow our beliefs to obstruct the truth. And this is what we mean about that inner change, that inner evolution. Because many times we see things and it's not really the correct way, but we always think we're right. And eventually we find we were wrong. The sooner we see that, the better. And the only way we can do that is to have the willingness to change. The willingness to change the way we look at things in life. The willingness to change our attitudes. The way that we've been trained, the way that we've been conditioned to see things in a different way, if it is truthful, if it is going to create a more peaceful and harmonious life for yourself and for others. I don't know how many, I always mention relationships because that is one of the greatest sources of happiness and suffering, you know, in the world. And sometimes what is the case that we want to change but we can't change? Why can't we change? Why are we so resistant to change? To change ourselves, change our behavior. A lot of time it's because we have fear of change. We don't know how to change. And it's really important to be someone who is very skilled in the ability to change. To develop the ability to change. and the courage to change, because only when you can encourage that change and have the skill to change and allow yourself to change, can you have this beautiful sense of freedom, the wisdom which can always change to every moment and adapt to every moment. It's the compassion to life, to open the door of your heart to life, an ability to let things go, let the past go, so you can be in the moment and always adapting and changing to life as it happens. If you can do that, you'll solve a lot of the suffering in life. So change, whether it's changing a religion, changing a view, changing a belief, when you find something better, is really, really important. There's one of the old Buddhist stories. This is a story from the Digha Nikaya, where two men went out to an abandoned region where people had migrated to see if they'd left anything of value which they could bring home, from which they could make some money. And what they say, went out to that abandoned village, one person found some old hemp, and so told his friends, so they made a big bundle of hemp to carry back to the village. It would be worth something. And on the way, that one of them noticed that there was some cloth made of hemp. So he said, this is what the hemp's for, to make cloth. So he threw away his bundle of hemp and took up the cloth. And the other guy said, no, this is already sort of packed up, this is good enough for me. He didn't want to change. And then later on they found out some cotton cloth. He said, cotton cloth is more important than hemp cloth, so I'm going to throw away my hemp cloth and take the cotton. The other guy said, this hemp is good enough for me. And then they found some silk. One guy threw away the cotton cloth and got some silk. The other guy, still with the pieces of hemp on his head, said, this will do for me. One person was always willing to change for something better. And then after they found some silk, they found some silver. So he threw away his silk and took some silver, and eventually they found some gold. So he threw away his silver to take the gold. And when they arrived back home, one had a whole pack of gold, the other one had some hemp. And the one, in a beautiful way the Buddha told the story, he said, the one who brought the hemp back brought no happiness to his family and got scolded by them. And the one who brought the gold back was welcomed with a lot of smiles by his family. And there's a simile which the Buddha gave, to always be willing to change one thing for something better. Especially in the ideas and views which one has about life. So if one does find a better religion, then be willing to change. There's nothing wrong with, if you find something which suits you better, follow that. And the great thing of Buddhism, we don't have any fear of trying to control people and make people Buddhists. If that's what you want to be, wonderful, fine. Obviously, I think this is very, very good and beautiful and wonderful. But you have to be in this spiritual path, be willing to change, willing to grow, willing to let the old go, so you can actually find something more beautiful. To be allowing yourself to change and grow. Otherwise, you'll be one of these people who's so dogmatic, who has these old views which you've carried around for such a long time, unwilling to change, only because you're comfortable with your old views and not willing to change for something better. Like the man who came home with hemp on his head when he had the opportunity to change it for gold. We call that attachment to views and ideas. Not willing to let things go. Because letting things go is the meaning of change. So that's the talk this evening on change.